This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents The Housekeeper by Natalie Barelli, narrated by Susie Bernice. Chapter 1. I am sitting in a large leather armchair, a reading chair. It is so comfortable that I never want to leave it. It's square, like a hollowed-out cube, and when I rub my hands slowly along the top of the thick arms, I find it's even softer than it looks. The leather is made to look old. Distressed, they'd call it. It's not really my style, but it is, without a doubt, the most comfortable chair I've ever sat in. It's also north of $2,000, so you'd want it to be. I am waiting for the guy who is going to interview me. This is his store, Beehive Furniture. I don't really want to be here, except for the chair. So I'm going to get it over and done with, and then I'm going home. He walks in and frowns at me. I get flustered at how much I've been enjoying his furniture, and stand up immediately, feeling the blush creep up my neck, and shake his hand. "Hello, I'm Jack. What's your name again?" "Claire." He does a little flick of the head, just a tiny one, and smiles, like he's waiting for a punchline. "That's my name," I chirp in the light sing-song voice I use when I want people to like me. But I bet he thinks the name is a bad match. I know I do. It's such a pretty name and completely wasted on me. Claires are tall and elegant. They are kind, sunny individuals with open faces and good intentions. I am none of those things. I am about as un-Claire as you can get. I am overweight and lazy. I have bad skin. My hair is always limp, no matter how many products I rub in it. Everything about me is washed out, beige. I should be called Charolais or something, or Bovinia. Although April says I'm not overweight, just a little behind in my gym routine. Jack releases my hand and wipes it quickly on his jacket pocket.
"Okay, well, it's this way."
Sometimes, when I take the time to think about it, which admittedly isn't often, I do think I'm strange. I didn't used to be, but circumstances have tipped me over that invisible edge. Now, everyone else seems normal and well-adjusted. They have friends and go to book clubs. They live in the suburbs and watch their kids play sports on Sundays and have barbecues afterwards. They throw dinner parties and drink crisp Chardonnays out of tall, stemmed glasses and laugh at each other's jokes, then remember a shared anecdote and argue about who remembered it better, and the whole thing will look like an old episode of Friends. Meanwhile, I sit in my room and eat Doritos dipped in salsa, while binging on old revenge seasons. I have one friend, April. I met her through Craigslist when I was looking for a place to live. Large 1BR in 2BR apartment, Soho, all inclusive. My room is nothing flashy, and I did think calling it large was a stretch, no pun intended. But it's big enough for my double bed, wedged as it is between the wall and a dresser, and it has a closet with a tall mirror on the front that I've covered up with a strip of wallpaper. The window looks onto the back courtyard, which I'm not crazy about. I'd prefer the street, but at least it's quiet. Unless it's winter, which is when the oil heater under my window starts to go nuts, making noises like someone has taken a sledgehammer to it, and I wake up with my heart somersaulting in my chest. April works hard. She's an HR lawyer or something to do with employment, and she's constantly busy. She was able to get herself a mortgage, which, to some extent, I am paying off. Sometimes she'll even accept goods instead of money.
Like the Saint Laurent bag I stole from a store once, but pretended it was gifted to me in exchange for posting a pretty picture of it on social media. She didn't seem concerned by the tear where the security tag had been. "You're an influencer?" she had asked, wide-eyed. "Sometimes I worry about April." It would be too easy to take advantage of her, which seems kind of weird, if her job is to make sure others are not taken advantage of. She only asked because of my social media habit, and maybe because I lie occasionally. One day, when she asked me what I was doing all the time on my screen, I showed her other people's glamour shots and pretended they were mine. The truth is, I only work 2 mornings a week, and on other days I spend an average of 6 to 8 hours scrolling on my phone and trolling people on Instagram. Is that strange? I don't know. Sometimes I tell myself that I don't live in a dark basement eating mold off the walls, so I'm okay. I'm not crazy, just a little obsessive. My addiction to Instagram started like everyone else's addiction to social media. I wanted to see what all the people I once knew were doing now. These were girls I just about grew up with. Girls who shared the same luxurious lifestyle as I had, whose parents frequented the same exclusive clubs, who even used the same shopping assistants, the same stylists as my parents. Girls who vacationed in the same locations as we did, Telluride in winter, St. Bart's in summer, the Hamptons or Cape Cod on weekends. I didn't know anyone outside that world until I got shut out of it. After a while, stalking my old friends became more than a hobby. These women were living my life, essentially. I imagined myself in their photos, my face cut out and stuck over theirs. I imagined being married to their husbands or engaged to some hot guy who'd gone to an Ivy League university and was now running his father's hedge fund. Like them, I would have small children by now, as well as an incredibly important and glamorous job. Like them, I would be incredibly busy, what with juggling my perfect life and my perfect career and my perfect kids. But I'm not busy, unless you count my 2 mornings a week of dubious employment at Dr. Lowe's office, which is why I have time to stalk. It goes without saying that my profile has nothing to do with me. Who wants a sad, pathetic 24-year-old loser in their timeline? No, my 55 followers think that I am a freelance publicist / eternal optimist. My posts are collages of stock photos, me not me, in exotic places, my fake office with its fabulous vision board, my hot boyfriend, the back of his head anyway, in bed, crumpled sheets down his back. It's incredible how easy it is, really, and I'm not even trying. I'm only interested in stalking my old friends. So no, I'm not an influencer. That goes without saying. But I gave April the Saint Laurent bag in exchange for a whole month's rent, so that was good. Now, I am only at this job interview because of her. I would never have bothered otherwise. But she has this thing, this faith in me, I call it. She insists on trying to pull me out of my misery. She's like a missionary sent to promote the power of positive thinking in a foreign country, with me being the foreign country. I don't want to be pulled out of it, April. I like my misery. It's taken a lot of effort to be this miserable. Why would I throw it all away? You're so melodramatic. I really don't know why you'd put yourself down all the time. You're very pretty. Just, you know, take care of your skin, put some makeup on. Go out for a walk every day and you'll lose a few pounds in no time. You won't recognize yourself. You'd make an excellent motivational speaker, you know that? Or a cult leader. You don't know what you're missing, that's all. Get a job. Go out more. Make some friends. You'll find out. Whatever. Any more Doritos in the bag? The owner of Beehive Furniture is a good friend of April's. He mentioned to her in passing that they were looking for a new admin person. Someone who could check inventory, issue invoices, and, this was the clincher for her, someone who could manage their social media marketing. She recommended me.
It's perfect for you. You're just the person they need.
But back to April, who had this fixation about me applying for this position. I already have a job, April.
Answering the phone 2 mornings a week isn't exactly a career, even if it is well paid for what it is.
April often wonders out loud how I manage to pay $1,320 in rent on 2 mornings work a week at a small medical office in Midtown. Like most people, if I could not work at all, I wouldn't. But whatever money my family ever had is long gone. So when I dropped in to see my doctor for my antidepressants prescription, and his part-time receptionist had just quit because a patient had puked on her open-toe shoes, and the office had descended into total chaos, I said, "I'll tell you what, Dr. Lowe, I'll work the phones for you today, and you don't charge me for the next 5 visits. How about it?" By the end of the day, he'd offered me the job. I was the receptionist 2 mornings a week, from 8 a.m. until noon, for a measly $11 an hour, whereupon Sally, the other receptionist, would take over. In my 2nd week, I arrived 20 minutes early and walked in on him enjoying some me time with some big tits fetish website. "You can feel mine if you like, $100, I said. "I have big breasts, and they're not being used right now. I figured I may as well put them to work." That worked out fine. So much so that for a weekly hand job and a boob feel, my salary went up $250. Like I said, I'm lazy. Needless to say, April doesn't know that part, and when she says, "Every job has its dignity, no matter how menial," she means even answering phones.
"But you're capable of so much more, Claire. Don't you want a career? Build a life?"
"No, I don't. And I don't have any experience, not real experience, not like a marketing person."
"It's not a marketing job, Claire. It's an admin position with plenty of scope. That's the beauty of it, don't you see? You could become a marketing person because you would be so good at this."
"Well, I don't have anything to wear for a job interview anyway, so that settles it." She gave a small shake of the head.
"You always exaggerate."
And before I could stop her, she was in my bedroom pulling out clothes from my wardrobe and throwing them over her shoulder and onto the unmade bed.
"You have all these beautiful clothes, Claire. Why don't you wear any of them?"
"Because they don't fit me. I don't even know why I keep them." I took the silver evening dress from her grasp and returned it to its rightful place, balled up at the back of the closet. In the end, she settled on a tailored blazer and matching flare pants in a small black and white check pattern. "This is mine?" I asked, taking the coat hanger from her. I didn't even recognize it. I wondered if I'd stolen that, too. "Forget it, I'll look ridiculous."
"No, you won't. You'll look great. Professional, but also edgy. Influential."
Lazy people can be pretty stubborn, and I'm no exception. But no one could withstand April when she set her mind on something. In the end, it was easier to give in, even though I knew full well I had virtually no hope of getting this job. But now that I'm here chatting with Jack and his business partner, Kate, something shifts. It takes a moment to figure out what, but then it clicks. I'm having a good time. I begin to think that maybe, just maybe, I could do this. Tell us about yourself, Claire.
I'm hardly going to tell them the truth, but this is an admin job and I can operate a computer and answer calls. I also have a talent for acting, which is something I've realized over the years and have used to my advantage many times. Anyway, April must have said lots of nice things about me because Jack and Kate want to know if I have any thoughts about marketing the brand on social media. As it happens, I do. They listen. They like my ideas. They take notes and ask questions. They thank me for my suggestions. They laugh at my jokes, which always makes me bolder. And by the time I leave 30 minutes later, I am thinking that this job could be fun. Jack and Kate seem really nice, and now I wish I'd worn something else. This outfit I have on belongs to someone tall and slim, someone who oozes confidence. A proper Claire. Then, yes, sure, it screams cool, edgy. On me, it says, I don't know, clown. I step out of the building just as a woman walks past with her dog on a leash, some small black stocky thing that immediately barks at me, saliva dripping from its exposed fangs.
Coco, enough, she shouts.
Then she looks at me apologetically.
Sorry, I'm so sorry. Coco!
But she's barely strong enough to restrain that thing. And as she pulls at the leash with both hands, her pretty pink Kate Spade handbag somehow slides off her arm and onto the sidewalk. There's a split second where I consider grabbing it and making a run for it, but notwithstanding the barking beast, I'm in a good mood.
Don't worry about it, I say, waving my hand.
And let's face it, this is Manhattan, the Upper East Side. You can't walk 5 feet without getting entangled with some Italian leather leash with hand-sewn edges, a Dior-clad socialite at one end and a Tibetan mastiff at the other. She gives me a small smile, picks up both the purse and the dog, and walks away briskly on heels so thin and sharp she could play darts with them. I reach for my cell to call April.
How did it go? She yells into the phone.
Yeah, good. Where are you?
Subway, Delancey. One sec.
I turn onto Park Avenue, wedge the phone in the crook of my neck, and fish around my bag for my Metro card. It's hot and sticky, the kind of day that sends everyone in and out of stores in search of air conditioning, and I'm sweating. It's also lunchtime and therefore seriously busy. Avoiding people takes some skill. A waft of perfume makes me look up. Something about the scent triggers a distant memory that I can't quite catch. Or maybe it's the familiar smell of money that makes my nostrils twitch. I'm right next to Alex Moreno's salon, where everyone in this neighborhood gets their hair done. An elegant woman, mid-40s maybe, dressed in a light metallic ensemble, and now sporting a perfectly layered shoulder-length cut, has just walked out. She's probably called Claire. I glance briefly inside without thinking, and there's a split second when the whole world stands still. It's her. Chapter 2. I stop so abruptly that someone behind me knocks my shoulder, sending me stumbling forward. I turn around to glare at the young man. He takes out one earbud and makes a frustrated clicking sound with his tongue. I hiss at him, bared teeth, and he jumps back before giving me a wide berth. I retrace the last couple steps so that I am again standing in front of the salon.
Did you hear what I said?
April's voice in my ear. I forgot I still held the phone. And yet I am clutching it so hard against my ear it hurts the cartilage.
You're breaking up, April. I'll see you at home.
I hang up. She's here, in New York, in Alex Moreno's salon.
I'd say I couldn't believe my eyes, but I know I'm right. It's not so much that I recognize her. It's that I feel her. Like the sight of her brought back memories that slice right through the barely healed scars. The door has closed again, and I don't want to go inside in case she spots me. Would she recognize me? I doubt it. Most days I don't recognize myself. I am nothing like the slim, confident girl from all those years ago. Back then I had porcelain skin and long, wavy blonde hair that cascaded down my back. Now it's dull and limp. If my mother could see me now, after all the money she spent on my education and appearance, I swear she would die. But then she's already dead, so... It should have been me in there, getting my hair styled by Alex Moreno, stylist to the stars. And she should have been at home, wherever that was, her head hanging over a small chipped bathroom sink, her hair sticky with Clairol Nice and Easy in medium caramel brown, with cold rivulets of water running down her neck and wetting the back of her t-shirt. I get close to the glass, but the frosted pattern makes it almost impossible to see inside. I move to a spot with more glass, less frost, both hands cupped around my face. There she is. I stare at her in the large wall mirror, what is left of my heart breaking into a thousand shards. She's flicking through a magazine, eyes cast down. She's prettier than I remembered. More woman, self-assured. Something in the way she runs one long finger over her eyebrow. Behind her, a guy with a short stubble is waving a hairdryer around her head. And there's a moment when her hair flies out in all directions, and she looks like Medusa. And then she looks up at me. Her eyes meet mine, and I stand back and hold my breath. But I'm wearing a pair of knockoff Burberry sunglasses, the large, wide-framed type. And as I said, I don't look anything like the happy, naive 13-year-old I was then. Proving my point, she goes right back to staring at herself while her hair gets pulled and styled and straightened. She has no idea who I am. There's an Italian bakery on the corner with a single wrought iron chair and a small round table outside. I sprint over to it, feeling the sweat trickle under my armpits, and I don't think it's just because of the temperature. I settle myself on the chair and drop my bag on the table, scouring the contents for a crumpled Kleenex, then pat the beads of sweat off my neck. Then I put the phone back to my ear and pretend to listen. But my eyes are trained on the front door of the salon. What is she doing in New York? She lives somewhere out in the sticks, doesn't she? Somewhere cold and wild where they cut a circle in the ice, drop a fishing line, and call it lunch. She must be rolling in money if she can afford to get her hair styled at Alex Moreno's. Isn't she scared someone might recognize her? I am biting the skin around my thumbnail so hard I draw blood. Small specks of it purling on the edges. I'm still holding my cell against my ear when a heavyset woman with tight black curls and a white apron comes out of the bakery with both hands on her waist and her head tilted at an angry angle. "Can I help you?" she snaps. "No, you can't. Get lost." I'm not looking at the hair salon anymore. I point at the phone as if that explains everything, because I'm not going to waste $5 on an overrated espresso. Not even if it's made with Icelandic glacial water and then filtered again for extra purity. I'm about to tell the woman that my fiancé has been in a car accident and I'm trying to find out which hospital they took him to, when she walks right past me. She doesn't notice me, doesn't even throw a sideways glance in my direction. She readjusts the strap of her Chanel monogrammed bag on her shoulder, and I catch the diamond and platinum wedding band on her finger. "No, thank you," I say. I throw my phone back into my bag and follow her. I don't know where we're going or how long it's going to take, but I am right behind her anyway. I keep back a few paces, enough to keep track of her, but not so much that I'd fall over her if she stopped abruptly. She looks so pretty, so confident, with her summer skirt flowing left and right in time with her brisk step. She's wearing a light denim jacket that on her manages to look elegant and cool, with her wavy brown hair down to her shoulders and parted in the center. Like her skirt, her hair bounces prettily with every step, while I am biting down on my own teeth and digging nails into my palms. She crosses to the other side of Madison Avenue and stops abruptly outside Ralph Lauren, and I feel exposed. If she turned around right now, she'd see me sticking out like a living statue on the street corner. I fish around my bag for my cell, pull it out, and pretend to check the screen. But all the time I have my eye on her. She pushes her sunglasses. Real brand ones, I bet, not some knockoff pair she found on the bus, to the top of her head. As it happens, there is a text from April. "Everything okay?" it reads. But she's on the move again. She flicks her wrist, and I figure she must be running late because she takes off faster. I sure hope she doesn't hail a cab. But if she does, I am ready with my cell in hand to snap the license plate so that later I could call in and spin a story that would hand over the destination. There's a French pâtisserie on the next corner. I know it well, and normally I'd stop and get myself a macaron because eating is what I do. But not this time. My stomach is clenched shut. Now we are walking along Central Park, and I'm sweating profusely. I knew I should have worn a skirt in this weather, but I'm not a skirt person, not with this body, and now the fabric is chafing my skin on the inside of my thighs. She turns onto East 63rd, and I cross to the other side before doing the same, as if going places of my own. She stops outside one of the nicest townhouses on this block. A brick brownstone, more red ochre than its neighbors, with a large terrace on the top floor. Then, abruptly, the front door opens and swallows her inside. I used to live two blocks from here. Everything around here is familiar to me because it is part of my childhood, which is why I never, ever come here if I can help it. I have not been above 34th Street for years. I wait a few minutes in case she comes out again, and then I cross the street and scan the front door. There's no plaque, nothing to indicate who she's seeing inside. I press my palm against the stone, its granite texture digging into the soft pads of my hand. I keep pushing until it hurts.
"Are you all right?"
a voice asks behind me. I turn around. "Yes, thank you," I say to the elderly woman in my sweetest voice. She nods briskly and walks on. I had a life once, a life nicer than most. The kind of life you have when you live in a brownstone just like this one. Then Hannah Wilson showed up and took it away from me. I think of Hannah Wilson just about every day. Some days I try really hard not to think about her, which just makes it worse. Hannah Wilson is like a scab on my heart. I pick at the events of 10 years ago, usually without thinking. It's just how things are. Sometimes I imagine a different outcome, one where we find out what she's really like before it's too late. In that fantasy, the whole world finds out how evil she is, how wronged our family was. The world feels sorry for us. And she goes to jail. But it just makes me more angry. And within minutes into the fantasy, my chest is throbbing with indignation anyway. April is already there when I get home that night. She's never home before 7. Is it that late already? I ask, fake surprised like a spouse who promised to be home in time for dinner, but instead has spent the last hour at the bar having just one more for the road.
You got the job,
she says, ignoring my question. She's standing at the sink, her back to me, turning faucets on and off again, and dropping this morning's breakfast dishes in the rack. How do you know?
They couldn't reach you, so they called me. Where were you all day?
Huh, I got the job. Wow. I pull out a chair and sit down heavily. I'm surprised, and flattered, too. I think that if I hadn't seen Hannah, I might have taken it. Strange to think about that, considering all the time I've spent actively avoiding getting a real job. She turns around.
Are you pleased?
I'm not going to take it, April.
Why the hell not?
Because there's no way I can go to work, move on with my life, not now that she's back. It's not for me. I'm sorry. I try to smile, but she shakes her head and turns back to the sink. I fill the void by telling her how sorry I am and that I appreciate what she's trying to do. You're a good person, April, and a good friend.
Next time, wash your own dishes. I'm not your maid.
We don't speak after that. She does what she always does, changes into her tracksuit pants and t-shirt, slips on her bed socks and drops herself on the couch to watch TV. At some point, she'll get up and heat up a bowl of noodles or one of those low-fat meals she keeps in the freezer. I retreat to my room, where my stash of chips and candy bars awaits, then stay up half the night looking for Hannah on social media. There are lots of Hannah Wilsons in the world, but the one I'm after doesn't like social media, which is not surprising, considering. But a few years ago, I found out she part-owned a flower store in Canada called 99 Petals. It was a public page, and there was a photo of her and another woman standing outside the storefront. Her name was in the caption. But I would have recognized her immediately anyway. It made me bite the inside of my cheek so hard it hurt to eat after that. She looked happy. Which was the worst part. At first, I assumed she worked there, but after reading the post, something about celebrating 1 year of the store, I realized she part-owned it with the other woman in the photo. Just knowing that she'd moved on like that, that she had a good life, made me want to bite someone. I called the store and ordered thousands of dollars worth of flowers. I was very convincing. It was for a celebration at a megachurch nearby, I'd said. Our usual florist was unable to oblige. I gave the real name and address and even paid $100 deposit. Then I waited until the day itself, when I figured they would have prepared all the arrangements, and I reported my credit card stolen. I told my bank I hadn't ordered flowers from Toronto. Why would I? I don't know anyone there. Then I added, it's funny though, because a friend of mine got their card charged without their knowledge for thousands of dollars worth of flowers. I'm pretty sure it was the same place. Maybe you should get your fraud department onto them. Sounds like a front for a shady business. I don't know if they lost thousands of dollars worth of flowers in the end, or if the bank investigated their business for fraud. But I like to think both are true. Anyway, I didn't find her last night. Nothing on Facebook or Twitter. I pored over Instagram, but I found nothing recent. Just a couple of shots from long ago on that flower store account. After that, I tried to sleep, but only managed snatches of moments with my eyes closed and the start of dreams of falling. Chapter 3. This morning, April has left already without saying goodbye. I make myself some breakfast, then I call Alex Moreno's and tell them I am calling on behalf of Hannah Wilson.
Who?
They say. Hannah, I stop myself. She's not Wilson anymore. I saw the wedding ring and the engagement ring with a stone the size of a small planet. Hannah, she was there yesterday, late morning.
Oh, you mean Mrs. Carter?
Mrs. Carter. Okay, there are lots of Carters out there, but that's a start.
Sorry, we're old friends,
I say, gagging inside. I've known her for so long under her maiden name, Wilson. I always forget to call her by her married name. I laugh, and she does too, because she has excellent customer service skills. I'm calling on the off chance you found her glasses case. It's pearl-colored with a gold rim. She thought she might have left it there. She'll check immediately, she says, if I could hold. Of course. Thank you. There's a bit of noise and talking, but muffled, as if she has her hand over the phone. Then she comes back, and she is very sorry, but no such case has been found. Does Mrs. Carter believe she left it at the salon? She's not sure. It was just a thought. Oh, well, if you happen to find it, could you have it delivered back to Mrs. Carter? There's a tiny intake of breath, understandably. After all, what's stopping Mrs. Carter from coming back to pick it up herself? And if it's not there now, why would it turn up later? But again, top-notch customer service skills. I'm going to leave a review on Yelp as soon as I hang up.
Of course, we'd be happy to, she says.
You have the address?
One moment.
I hear fingers on keyboard and fear she's going to ask me to spell it out. I'm thinking of ending the call. Oops, sorry, going through a tunnel. Can't hear you. When she reels off the exact address and asks,
Is that right?
But my heart drops and I hang up abruptly after all. It's the same building I saw her walk into. That address, it has to be one of the most expensive properties in Manhattan. And she lives there? I bite on my index finger until I almost bleed, leaving small purple teeth marks in a crescent shape. Then I bang my fist on the kitchen table, almost knocking the mug over. I pick it up and throw it hard in the general direction of the sink. But it doesn't even break. An hour later, I'm walking slowly past the building, glancing at the heavy oak door before continuing to the end of the block. I scout out both sides of the street, then turn the corner and lean back against an iron fence. I don't even have a plan, because I am stupid. I can't keep walking up and down the street. I'd get arrested before I had the time to say, Hannah Wilson, remember her? But there is no cafe, no park, nowhere for me to sit idly and wait. What there is, however, is a bar, right across the road. It's one of those exclusive establishments furnished with leather and mahogany and where you might sip a single malt in the afternoon. Not my usual haunt, but it will be open for lunch, and it has a large window made up of little squares of glass bordered by a timber frame. I still have 2 hours to kill before it opens, so I walk over to Central Park, which is literally right there, and find an empty bench. If Hannah lives in that building, then I am in no rush. I pull out my cell phone and open Instagram. Then, my chest heavy with apprehension, I search for Mrs. Hannah Carter, and boom, her face jumps out at me, beautiful and happy. And it hurts so much that I have to put the phone face down on my lap for a moment. But I have to know, so I look again, my stomach clenching a little more with every exquisite photo. Hannah Carter getting married at the Church of the Heavenly Rest, flowers everywhere. Mrs. Carter, a vision in white tulle and small pink buds. Mrs. Carter standing outside the church with confetti in her hair, laughing at something her husband had said. Mr. Carter, with one arm encircling his wife's waist and the other lifting a glass of champagne on a terrace at dusk. Then Mrs. Carter on her honeymoon in a picturesque small town in Provence, taking a selfie with green vineyards behind. Another one with the two of them on a terrace overlooking the Eiffel Tower. In every picture, he looks like he can't believe his luck. And she beams at the camera. I bite my knuckle again so hard, I know it will leave a bruise. Fuck you, Mrs. Carter. How did she do it? How did she ensnare him? She can afford a wedding in Manhattan and a honeymoon in France. Well, I have to flash my boobs just to make the rent. I've been hustling a living since my folks died, stealing cash from relatives and wiping tables. No one was offering to marry me at $200 a head for a 100-person guest list, linen and decorations not included. I lean forward, press the heel of my hand against my forehead, and will myself to calm down. I tell myself that now that I've found her again, maybe I can do something about it. It would be like a project. It would distract me. Within minutes, my pulse has returned to a manageable rate, and I am breathing normally again. I take another look at the screen. He's not what I expected, Mr. Harvey Carter, which means he's exactly what I expected. He's not particularly good looking. Certainly nothing like her. He must be in his late 40s, early 50s. He wears thick-rimmed glasses and his head is bald on top. He has a round face and in every photo, he is smiling. He reminds me of my father. My pulse again gets away from me and I look up to take a breath. And there she is, walking right past me. Only a few feet away. She must have just turned off her street. I shove my cell back in my bag and follow her down Fifth Avenue. She stops at a building two blocks away, and I wait until she's gone inside to check the copper plaque beside the door. Dr. Malone, M.D., psychiatrist. That cheers me up. Could the marriage already be on the rocks? Has life turned out to be harder than she thought? I take a photo on my cell and upload it to my fake Instagram account. Hashtag some people are evil. Hashtag some people are sick. Hashtag some people are both. I get a handful of comments immediately, mostly because it's so cryptic, and I never post stuff like that. Hashtag. All will be revealed. I grab a bagel with cream cheese from a deli across the street and eat it on the walk back without waiting for her. I kill time, an hour or so, by going in and out of fashion stores and trying things on I have no hope of buying. Then I go to the bar where I settle by the window and order a cup of coffee. Hannah returns and goes back inside. But not much happens after that, and by the third cup, the pretty waitress asks me if I'm waiting for someone. She feels sorry for me, I can tell. She thinks I've been stood up, but that I just can't see it. Like I can't give up, and I'm going to wait as long as it takes because I know deep down that he's coming for me. No, it's just me, I tell her, crushing her little fantasy into a pile of dust. Oh, she says, her pretty mouth shaping like a perfect circle, like she's about to blow a ring of smoke. She gives me a quick smile and leaves. At dusk, the lights come on in Hannah's house. The French doors upstairs are open onto the stone terrace, and I see a glimpse of an enormous glass chandelier. The next day, I take my place again at the window and notice the staff exchange glances. It's a different waiter, a young man with a cowlick and very thin fingers.
"Will someone be joining you?"
he asks. I smile. "No."
"But I'm ready for this question." "You don't mind, do you? I'm writing a screenplay."
I brandish a notepad and a pen. One side of his mouth rises in the beginning of a smile.
"Really? For a movie?"
"Not quite." I catch a sliver of condescension in the way he raises his chin. I've just confirmed to him that I'm a nobody, one of a million in this city who thinks she's going to send her screenplay to Martin Scorsese and win an Oscar. "It's for Netflix," I say. "A series. We've only sold the first season at this stage, but we're hopeful." I smile. Now he's interested, and we are back on track, me with my pen and a friendly waiter.
"Really? Can I ask what it's about?"
"It's about a horrible person who gets her comeuppance."
"It's a true crime story,"
I reply sweetly, "about a woman who cons married men and kills them. But it's impossible to work at home, you know, with all the noise. We're doing renovations, all 5 bathrooms. Nightmare. Anyway, the network has given me a strict deadline, and since I'm also scouting for filming locations. This place is nice, by the way. I'll bring it up at the next production meeting. You never know."
"Wow, that'd be awesome."
He hurries back to the bar where his colleagues are drying glasses and the 3 of them huddle in whispers, throwing the occasional side glance in my direction. They leave me alone after that because, you know, I have to work. But then Hannah's door opens, and she comes out with a stroller, and I'm so shocked that I knock the coffee cup over. I throw some coins on the table and follow her to the park, where she sits on a bench and pulls out a book. Then she changes her mind, taking a swaddled baby out and into her arms. But I can't bear to watch and go home early. I spend the next few days in the bar, at my window, as I've come to think of it, on high alert, my neck stretched, my eyes trained on the street, which is completely unlike me. I'm usually more sloth than meerkat. I never eat lunch there because, well, prices. But I still have consumed endless cups of tea or coffee, and I don't have any money to spare. Which means I'm going to be late on my rent this month, and April won't be pleased, considering I've turned down the job. And yet, I feel energized, elated. I have a purpose. At Dr. Lowe's office, people comment on how much happier I look. Dr. Lowe says my hand jobs are even more enthusiastic than usual, and he adds $50 onto my usual fee because of it. And Mrs. Usher, who comes every other day for her allergies and other imaginary ailments, because Dr. Lowe always tells her she's perfectly healthy, and yet she returns undeterred, comments on it. "There's something different about you," she says, frowning.
"There is? I don't know what you're talking about."
"You have a boyfriend. That's what it is." I laugh, and I swear Dr. Lowe's head snaps so fast, I think it might do a full rotation. And so, over the next 10 days, whenever I am not manning the phones for Dr. Lowe, I am at the bar. I don't even take off my coat in case she leaves her house and I have to run outside. It kind of helps in a way. The staff think I must be an artist because I'm eccentric. One time I followed her to Bergdorf Goodman, where I pretended to browse while watching her try on a pair of Jimmy Choo shoes. Then she took a Valentino dress that the saleswoman had pushed onto her into the changing rooms. And I considered trying on a Donna Karan silk shirt, just so I could join her.
Excuse me, can I get your opinion? Does it make me look fat?
In the end, she bought a very ordinary black lacy number off the rack. Not even from the designer section. I was understandably confused. But then I understood. It's her husband's money. She's pretending to be reluctant, like she didn't marry him because of it. Like she really loves him. He'll think that's so sweet. And when he trusts her completely with his money, she'll pounce and take him to the cleaners.
Slow clap, Mrs. Carter. Well played.
Then some days I don't see her at all. I only saw her husband once because he usually takes the car. A Bentley, no less. They have a single-car garage on the lower level, and I recognized his face. Other than obvious deliveries and couriers, there's only one other person who comes and goes. A woman, older than Hannah, in her 40s maybe. She's very thin, very straight-backed, like she trained in the army. I suspect she's part of the staff. Something about the way she moves, the way she hurries whenever she walks in or out. Especially out. Sometimes Hannah takes a cab. She has a habit of walking to Park Avenue to catch one. So I'd follow her for nothing and then come back to the bar. I told the waiter once it's because we're shooting around here and it's important to have a photo. It helps me complete the scene. It all sounds so far-fetched. I'd keep waiting for one of them to call the authorities or the psych ward. You guys missing anyone? But this is Manhattan, so anything goes, I guess. So far, she's gone back to her shrink twice. I wonder why, so I call to make an appointment for myself.
Dr. Malone has an opening on the 5th of December at 10:30.
December? But that's months away.
We're very busy, yes.
She says this smugly, the receptionist. Like it's a good thing I want to point out that being busy for a psychiatrist means she's not very good. I almost ask if they are repeat customers, those people hogging the calendar for months on end. Do you have a 10-visit discount pack? What does that say about your success rate, then? Asking for myself, I'm pretty fucked up, too.
Would you like to take the appointment?
Yes, please.
The first session is $270,
the smug receptionist says. I let out a snort, then pretend to cough.
Is that all right with you?
She adds. Yes, that's fine.
There's a 50% fee if you cancel less than 7 days before your appointment.
I have no intention of keeping it. Not at that price. I swap 2 digits in my Visa card number and give a fake cell number. Chapter 4. It was Olivia Cortez who first brought up with my mother the possibility of Hannah working for us. Our regular nanny, whose name I can't remember, was leaving to get married, and my mother hadn't as of yet found a replacement. In some kind of twisted irony, that summer was one of the best of my life. My best friend, Philippa, and I spent that month at a horseback riding camp together. My horse was called Button, a gorgeous creature, almost white, with a brown diamond shape above her nose. I can still remember the feel of her damp, cold nose against my cheek, how she would lift her head up when she'd see me and nuzzle me when I'd get close. I'd only been there for a few days when someone called out to me. "Your mother's on the phone," they said. After 10 minutes of catching up on news, she said, "And we found a nanny for John, did I tell you?"
"You did? That's nice,"
I said, biting into a red apple, turning to gaze out the window, my mind already disconnecting from the conversation. My mother, who could talk incessantly in those days, proceeded to tell me a convoluted story whereby her friend Olivia Cortez had a cousin in Canada who was married to someone or other, and at the end of that human chain was a young Canadian woman who wants to come to New York for the summer. She's looking for a position as a nanny. I'm told she's charming and great with children. Olivia said she wants to study art, and that's why she wants to come to New York. I think of this conversation sometimes, about how innocuous it was on the surface. And yet, this was the moment that began the sequence of events that would end with the death of both my parents. It still eats me up at night that I didn't recognize it. I imagine myself back there that day on the phone. "But what do you know about this girl, Mom? Has she done this work before? Does she have references? Can you even trust her?" My mother was the brightest light of my life. She was beautiful, caring, smart. She wanted me to become anything I set my mind to. She said I could be the first female president of the United States if I wanted to. Not because of my grades, which were okay, but because girls can do anything. "Anything you want," she'd say. I was sent to Groton School in Massachusetts, and I loved every minute of it. I'd just finished my freshman year by the time Hannah came into our lives. In the end, my mother said yes to Olivia Cortez, because if my mother could help someone, she did. She was generous like that, and it's what killed her. But she was looking for a nanny, and this young woman who wanted to come and spend a summer in New York was finding it difficult to find a position. In her mind, she was confident that Hannah Wilson would do a fine job. But more than that, you said something to my mother like, wants to better herself, would love to spend time at MoMA or whatever. And my mother was all over it. So she welcomed Hannah Wilson into our home and into our lives, and we all lived bitterly ever after. I saw Olivia Cortez once, years later, in a shopping mall of all places. I spat in her face. She had no idea who I was. It's now in the middle of the second week, and the novelty is starting to wear off. It's all very well following her around the place, watching her push a stroller or eat a Greek salad at Bel Ami, but it's not like I'm achieving anything. I have a bunch of photos, but the best I got was her picking her nose, so I only uploaded that one. Hashtag gross. I'm drinking so much tea and coffee, I'm beginning to vibrate. And I'm peeing all day. On top of that, I canceled work once because I was afraid she might go somewhere significant, and I'd miss out on finding out something about her. I suffer from Hannah Carter FOMO. "I'm sick," I told Dr. Lowe without a hint of irony. "I've got the flu, I think." I coughed a few times. He sighed into the phone. "He'll come in on Monday?" "Yes," I replied, because I have superpowers and I know exactly when I'll be well again. In the end, I didn't find anything out on that day. And now, finally, something happens. That same woman, the straight-backed one, walks out of Hannah's building, but this time she stops and rummages through a large black handbag hanging on her arm. She pulls out, what is it? A tissue, I think. It takes me a moment to realize that she's crying. I sprint to the top step outside the bar, but I'm not fast enough, and there's a man talking to her. He has one hand on her shoulder, like he's consoling her. I squint at them from my side of the street and wrap my coat tighter around me. "Ms. Peterson?" I turn around. "Yes?" Bill, the bartender, holds out a takeout paper cup. "Your espresso. You only just ordered it," I thought. "Oh, thank you. That's great." I take it from him and turn back. The man is still talking to her, one hand on her elbow. I want to run across the street and insert myself between them. But instead I act cool, distracted, as I pull out my cell and pretend to read something on my screen, my head down, like everyone else in this town. By the time I get to the other side, I am so involved in what I'm reading that I, quote, accidentally, end quote, bump into the back of her, spilling some of my coffee onto the sleeve of her coat. Oh, God, I'm sorry I didn't see you. The guy glares at me, which is fine. I'm good at glaring. I glare back. Here, let me, I say, taking a tissue from her and dabbing it gently at the sleeve. I'm really sorry.